All right, it's good to have you here, sticking around, coming back. You guys are gluttons for punishment to come and hear about persecution. You just really want to experience it today by being here all morning. So we're grateful for your attendance and thankful that you've chosen to spend this morning with us. As Dr. Hagen provided a historical overview of the period and some brief vignettes into some of the figures of Baptists that were experiencing persecution during this time. In my time, I would like to go a little bit deeper in one individual in particular. I have a strategy, just to paraphrase Charles Spurgeon, to make a beeline to Collins in my work. So I'm eventually going to get to Hercules Collins and dig in there. In his chapter on the period, an English Baptist of the 17th century, B.R. White, the dean of 17th century English Baptist studies, labeled the period, the years that we're looking at this morning, 1660 to 1688, as the era of the Great Persecution. Now, during that period, as has already been mentioned, all dissenters, including Baptists, experienced persecution. The result of that, the benefit for us, is that a rich literature was produced during that period. We know of Bunyan's writings, and we know of some others who produced just tremendously edifying works during their imprisonments and during their periods of persecution. And I'm going to introduce you to another individual as well this morning, a man by the name of Hercules Collins. And by looking at his writings in a little more detail, I hope we are able to gain a better understanding of how this persecuted minority of Baptists were able to persevere, how they were able to endure. And I think this is an important lesson because I believe that in our lifetimes, or at least in the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren, there will be persecution experienced once again, and we need to be prepared for it. The time to prepare is not after it happens, it's before it comes. And one of the best ways to learn is from those who've already experienced and learn from what they have learned and what they have taught us in terms of persevering. The writings that we're going to look at are characterized by at least four elements: confidence in the sovereign providence of God, thankfulness for both physical and spiritual blessings, reflection upon the sufficiency of Christ, and a certain expectation, an eschatological view, looking forward to future reward and deliverance. And so it's this kind of spirituality that I believe is the kind that will suffice to enable us to endure times of persecution if they come upon us. And so we're looking at that this morning. We are going to look at a little bit of historical setting, although it's been covered very thoroughly and better, but I just want to remind you of a couple of things because it's going to come up again in just a moment. Although Charles II had promised religious toleration when he returned to the throne following the Commonwealth of Oliver Cromwell, those hopes were short-lived among the dissenters. We don't know whether Charles actually had the intention of instituting his promise of religious liberty, but what we do know is what happened, and that is that Parliament introduced a series of laws between 1661 and 1665. That was the main section. Then also, as Dr. Aiken mentioned, 1670 and 1673 with the Second Conventicle Act and the Test Act. But these laws, collectively known as the Clarendon Code, whose purpose was to enforce uniformity, conformity to the Church of England, everyone worshiping in the same manner under the same official church. The Corporation Act, and I won't spend a lot of time on these because Dr. Hagen already explained these pretty well, so we'll just very briefly. Corporation Act of 1661 required anyone to have received the sacrament of the Lord's Supper in the Church of England within the past year in order to be eligible for election to a government office. The Act of Uniformity, 1662, which is, again, as Dr. Hagen mentioned, the act that really sets the date. It's the 350th anniversary of that, which was instituted August 24th of 1662, 350 years later, more or less. Here we are remembering the effects of that. That resulted in over 2,000 ministers being ejected from their pulpits. The Conventicle Act of 1664 and then the Second Act of 1670 forbade the assembling of five or more persons for religious worship other than Anglican. This act in and of itself essentially outlawed all dissenting churches. The Five Mile Act of 1665 forbade any nonconforming preacher or teacher to come within 5 miles or a city of a city or corporate town where he had previously served as minister, and that was also expanded later, as we'll see, just to forbid any nonconformist, any dissenter from preaching within 5 miles of a city. And as Dr. Haken mentioned about the difficulties of travel during that period, that would essentially take preachers away from population centers, which would, again, essentially outlaw any dissenting churches. So all of these acts were aimed at stamping out dissenters and Catholics. Baptists were hit particularly hard by these laws because they made their own conscientious worship of God illegal. One of the ministers whose life and ministry was affected by these laws was Hercules Collins, whose life spans this period. He was young. He would have been 16 or 17 in 1662 when the ejection took place, so he was not directly affected by that, but he is indirectly affected by the Clarendon Code in general, as we'll see, and then he lives to experience toleration as well in the 1680s. Collins served from 1677 until his death in 1702 as the third pastor of London's oldest Baptist church, which was then meeting in the Wapping area of London. The first pastor was a man by the name of John Spilsbury. The second pastor was John Norcott. And he is John Norcott. I have a brief statement on him. We do not know a lot about him, although the paper's title has Norcott and Collins in it. It's going to be unevenly treated, because what we do know about Norcott is that he was the second pastor of that church. His funeral sermon was preached by Benjamin Keach, so he was a man who was respected. And it is believed that he was one of a small number of Baptists who were actually ejected from their pulpits in 1662. But these laws, although these laws, this particular law affected Norcott, the other laws of the Clarendon Code, of which this act was a part, continued to have ripple effects for over a quarter of a century. Collins himself, who, as I said, would become the third pastor of this church following Norcott in 1677, first appears in the public records in June of 1670 as a 24-year-old, not yet a minister apparently, but he was arrested along with 13 others for assembling in a conventicle in violation of the Conventicle Act. Collins became pastor almost 1 year to the day after Norcott died in 1676. For the first half of his ministry, his congregation had to meet in secret for fear of persecution. Spies and informers were employed during this period by the government and given large sums of money for the discovery of dissenting congregations. The English Baptist historian Joseph Ivamy records that the meeting house of Collins' congregation was attacked during this period. The pulpit and pews were destroyed. Windows were smashed. In July of 1683, Collins was indicted for his failure to attend the local parish church. But it was for his violation of the Five Mile Act, which again had come to be used to forbid any nonconformist preaching within 5 miles of any town. It was on the basis of that act that Collins was actually imprisoned in 1684 at Newgate. Collins had addressed the Church of England in 1682 in one of his writings by saying, "If you do persecute us for our conscience, I hope God will give us that grace which may enable us patiently to suffer for Christ's sake." Apparently, God granted this desire, because the English Baptist historian Thomas Crosby, writing within 40 years of Collins' death, recorded that he was a faithful minister of the gospel. Though he had not a learned education, yet he was a useful and laborious servant of Christ and one that suffered imprisonment for his sake. He began to be religious early and continued faithful to the last, and was not shocked by the fury of persecutors. Ironically, it may have been that volume in which he expressed his willingness to suffer, which was titled Some Reasons for Separation from the Church of England, that was actually the cause of Collins' arrest in 1683 and imprisonment in 1684. In this work, which was framed as a debate between a hypothetical debate between a conformist and a nonconformist, Collins asserts the historic Baptist distinctive of religious liberty. Now, Baptists have always been ardent defenders of religious liberty since that very ideal is in their DNA because they're champions of regenerate church membership, which necessitates a separation of church and state. In other words, the idea, the principle of religious liberty that which we hold dear is a theological principle that flows out of theological commitments, soteriological commitments of what we believe conversion is, what happens at salvation, that individuals are converted by grace through faith in Christ. And then who makes up the church then? It's those who have been regenerated, who have shown their regeneration by responding in repentance and faith, and who show evidence of that through believers' baptism and unite together in individual congregations. So therefore, it's just the very essence of Baptist identity that flows out of these theological commitments that necessitates a view of the separation of church and state and therefore religious liberty. In the early 17th century, as you know, men such as John Smith, Thomas Helwys, Roger Williams were all advocates for religious liberty. Collins seems to be very familiar with the writings of one of these, at least, Roger Williams, his 1644 work on religious liberty called The Bloody Tenet of Persecution. He places in Collins some reasons for separation from the Church of England. In certain places, he follows Williams very closely, citing the same sources in the same order, saying the same that they didn't have the same kind of rules, copyright rules and plagiarism rules that exists today, and so there was a lot of freedom of sharing material then. But Collins offers his own concise summary of the issue at stake in terms of religious liberty by asserting in his own words, in, again, I'm quoting some reasons for separation from the Church of England, he said that none should be compelled to worship God by a temporal sword, but such as come willingly, and none can worship God to acceptance but such. For this principle, which preserves the ideal of freedom of worship, Baptists like Hercules Collins were willing to risk their health, safety, and freedom. Within a year of having published some reasons for separation, and by the next, within a year, what that should say, within a year of having published, he was arrested. The next year, 1684, he was imprisoned for exercising his understanding of religious liberty. Nevertheless, this time in prison bore rich fruit, for while he was in the infamous Newgate prison, Collins penned two of his most devotional of his 12 writings. And that's those two works we're going to focus on in the remainder of this paper. These are the prison writings of Hercules Collins, one titled Counsel for the Living, Occasioned by the Dead, and one called A Voice from Prison. There's no indication of which one was published first, but we're going to look first at Counsel for the Living, Occasioned from the Dead. The distinction between the two works is probably more in whom their audience is. Who is Collins intending to address? Collins in this work is addressing his fellow prisoners, those who are in prison with him. And this work perhaps comes from a sermon that he even delivers in the context of the prison, certainly a discourse that he's prepared for their benefit. His other work, which we'll look at, A Voice from Prison, is a voice from prison to his church and to those outside of prison who are also experiencing persecution but who are not there located with him. This work, Counsel for the Living, Occasioned from the Dead, is a discourse on Job 3:17-18, which was written on the occasion of the death of two of Collins' fellow prisoners at Newgate, Francis Bamfield and Zachariah Ralphson. Both apparently died in early 1684 while Collins was with them in prison. Job 3:17-18 states, and curiously, this is that familiar text maybe in Job, hopefully to you, where Job laments the day of his birth. He wishes he was stillborn. He wishes he were dead. And in the context of that, Collins takes, perhaps out of context, something that Job says that's very true about death. And that's what we're reading here in Job 3:17-18. There the wicked, that is in death, there the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They hear not the voice of the oppressor. Collins summarized those verses as containing three components: the subjects, which are the oppressed and the oppressors. Secondly, the predicate, they shall rest. And thirdly, the receptacle, or the place of rest, that's the grave. Collins' work focused on two aspects of counsel from Job 3:17-18, namely the future judgment of persecutors and the corresponding relief of the persecuted that comes in death. Collins believed that both of these ideals was present in these verses and was pertinent for his times. The persecuted needed to be encouraged by the fact that one day the persecutors would be stopped and they would experience relief, if not in this life, then in the life to come. Persecutors needed to realize that they would one day be judged for their mistreatment of the people of God. So Collins' primary purpose in this discourse was to provide comfort to persecuted Christians. That's seen at the end of the book, how he exhorts his readers to follow the Apostle Paul's advice at the end of his discourse on the resurrection of saints in 1 Thessalonians 4 to comfort one another with these words. Collins wants his words to be used as a source of comfort for others. Collins concludes his counsel for the living by exhorting his readers with these words, "While sin, Satan, and an unkind word is discomforting you, do you, in a lively hope of the resurrection of the body, the coming of Christ, your meeting of him, and continuing with him, cheer up and comfort one another with these things." Before turning to offer comfort for the persecuted, Collins first, though, indicted their persecutors as godless men. Collins characterized the persecutors of Christians as wicked men who are, quote, troublers of the church. As such, they are strangers to gospel principles, to a gospel spirit and gospel teachings. Collins concluded that a persecuting spirit is not of a gospel complexion. He has this same kind of idea that's communicated in that section on religious liberty that I mentioned in some reasons for separation from the Church of England. He talks about how the sword should never be used in order to enforce worship. And his point there, when he speaks about how he should be, the quote we read earlier about how he would be willing, he prayed that God would enable him to be willing to endure suffering, to endure persecution. The context is that he would never lift up a sword in order to defend himself, but instead he prays for God's grace to enable him not to fight back, but to endure persecution. Judgment, he says, though, is coming for those evildoers who shall be made to confess their wickedness in not setting God's people at liberty to worship him. They shall fall into mischief and be silent in darkness and turned into hell with the nations which forget God. Note that the liberty to worship him. Likewise, Collins excoriated the persecutors elsewhere for arresting elderly men. Men of 80 years of age, hurried to prison for nothing else but for worshiping their God. This seems to have especially raised the ire of Collins, since Bamfield, one of the men whose death occasioned this sermon, was almost 70 when arrested for what would prove to be the final time. Saints, however, would be given rest. "The time is coming," Collins asserted, "when God hath promised we shall no more hear the voice of the oppressor. The saints shall know no more apprehendings, nor hear no more of, 'Take him, jailer. Keep him until he be cleared by due course of law.' We shall have no more bolts nor bars then on us, no more looking for the keeper then, nor speaking to friends through iron grates." That quote is just so vivid for me as I read those words and think about it. I can almost hear the sound. I mean, you have a sense as Collins writes that he can hear the voice of the jailer. He can hear the voice of the judge saying, "Take him, jailer, keep him till he be cleared of his charges by the due course of law." He can hear the clanging of the bars and the bolts as the prison doors are closed. And he says, "We're not going to hear that anymore. There's a day of relief that is coming. We're not going to have to speak to our friends through the iron grates. We're not going to have to keep on the watch for the keeper of the jail constantly." The rest that he's referring to is that rest in Job 3:17 and 18 was a rest in sleep, being then out of all sense of care, trouble, pain, and all manner of distraction. So in like manner shall we be in the grave. This was the rest which Bamfield and Ralphson had attained. However, this was not the only relief from persecution that Collins anticipated. His belief in the sovereign providence of God caused him to declare, "We shall none of us stay a night beyond God's determination." Therefore, prisoners could be content with their circumstances. "Though limited to one room," he said, "which was our kitchen, our cellar, our lodging room, our parlor." Like the Apostle Paul, these persecuted believers had learned to be content in every state. That didn't mean Michigan and Kentucky. That meant in prison or out of prison, in freedom, or in a period of persecution. In fact, Paul's words only make sense if there is such a reality as suffering and persecution in the life of a believer. And so these believers had learned to be content in the state they were in. They had learned and they believed that place is best where their Father had willed them to be. Having their daily bread, they confessed that God is as good in prison as out. Collins therefore exhorted his readers that God's promises were not just to be read, but their truths were to be trusted and experienced. Beloved, he said, it's one thing to read the promises, another thing to trust upon God by them and experience the truth of them. These prisoners had experienced the promised presence and blessing of God in the prison cell, and Collins wanted to exhort other persecuted Christians to trust in these promises of their loving Father. Collins reminded his readers of God's providence, that God's providential dealings with his people in this world is like checker work. There's the dark as well as the light side of providence. The most refined and best state and condition of the best saints are mixed here. If we have some peace, we have some trouble. If we have large comforts one day, we may expect a great degree of trouble another. Lest we should be exalted above measure, we must have a thorn in the flesh now and then. Trusting God's providence, Collins could confidently declare, let men and devils do their worst. God will in his own time loose the prisoners. Not only were Collins and his fellow persecuted brothers content with their situation because of God's providence, they were also deeply thankful for God's physical and spiritual blessings, even while jailed. Collins called these blessings prison comforts. They blessed God for his grace, which enabled them to have as much peace and satisfaction in their one-room prison cell as when they had complete liberty to stroll through their houses, gardens, and the homes of their friends. They were also thankful for God's daily physical provisions for them. Blessed be God, we have bread for the day, as the day so our strength has been. These prisoners, however, were most grateful for their spiritual blessings. Chief among these blessings was the presence of Christ. Of his persecuted brothers, Collins could write, how much of the presence of Christ have they had to enable them to bear the cross quietly, patiently, contentedly. These saints also rejoiced that though they were bound by physical shackles, they had been set free from the bondage of sin and death. Again, let us bless God, though we are in the prison of man, yet that we are delivered from the spiritual prison of sin and Satan into the glorious liberty of the children of God, and out of the kingdom of darkness into the glorious light of the gospel. They realized that the darkness of a material prison is nothing to the darkness of a spiritual one. In this spiritual freedom, believers may have liberty in bonds, light in darkness, peace in trouble. It was the spiritual blessings which enabled the suffering servants of Christ to endure their trials. Collins explained how he and his fellow prisoners had personally experienced the soul-strengthening power of spiritual fellowship with the Father. Communion with God by the Spirit is a good cordial to keep up the heart from fainting in this valley of tears until we come to our mount of joy, where there is no limits of joy and blessedness. The second work which Collins published from his prison cell was A Voice from the Prison. This work was an extended meditation on Revelation 3:11, where Christ admonished the church of Philadelphia with the words, Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. You can see here how it is addressed now, not to those in prison with him primarily, but to his congregation, encouraging them in the face of persecution to hold fast. Collins addressed his sermon on the title page to the Church of God, formerly meeting in Old Gravel Lane, Wapping, and all who were strangers and foreigners, but now fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God. In this sermon, Collins drew from at least 213 passages of Scripture. This is, of course, characteristic of the writings of the Puritans and of the 17th century Baptists. The writings are saturated with Scripture. He quotes from at least 213 passages of Scripture to encourage his congregation to stand firm in the face of persecution. Collins urged his besieged flock to not abandon the cause of Christ. Hold fast what thou hast. When Satan would pull thy soul's good from thee, when relations, husband, wife, children call upon you and persuade you because of danger to cease from the work of the Lord, then hold fast. You get the imagery, at least I do, of John Bunyan's character Christian. and hearing the family, the relations crying after him, come back. But Collins is urging his congregation that when those temptations come, to come back, to hold back, to deny your faith, to hold fast in that day. Collins offered a motivation for holding fast to Christ and his work. It's what they would hear if they persevere, what they would hear from what they would hear Christ profess to the Father on the day of judgment. Imagine hearing these words: "These are they which continued with me in my temptation. Therefore I appoint unto you a kingdom. Therefore, because you owned me in an evil day, these are the men, women, people which spoke of my testimonies before kings, and were not ashamed when many cried, 'Crucify him at his cause.' These are the souls which came forth and declared they were on the Lord's side. These are they, Father, whose love to me many waters nor floods could not quench nor drown. These have made choice of me with reproaches, imprisonments, with fines, confiscation of goods, banishment, loss of limbs, life, and all. They have borne all, endured all for my sake. In the greatest affliction they kept from wavering. And the more they endured and lost for my sake, the more they loved me." Just as Collins had encouraged persecuted believers in his counsel for the living to not give in because of the future rest which awaited them, so too, in a voice from the prison, he exhorted them to live in view of their future appearance before God's judgment seat, and not in terms of the persecution that the judgment that the persecutors would receive, but here the words that which Christ would speak of them. This is the blessed hope that has always been a source of encouragement to God's people, especially in times of persecution. Collins also drew comfort for his people from God's sovereign providence during his imprisonment. He began his written address to his dearly beloved church by expressing his confidence that God was providentially at work in his suffering for the advancement of the gospel. "For as much," he said, "as I am present, deprived by my bonds of the liberty of preaching, I bless God I have the advantage of printing, being ready to serve the interest of Christ in all conditions to my poor ability. And doubt not, but God and interest are served by my confinement as by liberty, and am not without hopes that I shall preach as loudly and as effectually by imprisonment for Christ as ever I did at liberty, that all those who observe God's providential dealings will be able to say with me hereafter, as holy Paul once said in his bonds at Rome, 'What hath befallen me hath tended to the furtherance of the gospel.'" Like the Apostle Paul in Philippians 1, Collins' belief in the providence of God caused him to have confidence that God would bring good out of his imprisonment. One of the goods that Collins believed could come out of the sufferings of the Baptist was that some of their adversaries might be convinced by how they patiently endured when they were persecuted. He argued that since actions are more influential than words and more demonstrative of the truth and reality of a person or cause, and as a man shall be better believed for his good works than good words, suffering patiently would convince their persecutors. Collins therefore encouraged his congregation, "So if we would manifest our integrity under a profession, nothing will do it better than your suffering, if by God called unto it. For as a tree is known by his fruit, so is a Christian by a patient wearing Christ's cross. This will and hath convinced an adversary when a bare profession will not." Here echoes of Tertullian, "The blood of the martyrs is seed." Collins here is expressing his belief that God will use this suffering that they're experiencing, the persecution that they're undergoing, for the advancement of the gospel. In a similar manner, in Counsel for the Living, Collins had maintained that God would make people grow so much the more as their afflictions abound, for thinking people will conclude they must be the Lord's that suffer patiently under such apparent wrong. Therefore, Collins encouraged his fellow believers to see how our churches feel. "Come, let us go on. We have good success. We shall bring them all home at last." This would apparently prove to be true for Collins and his congregation, since by the time of his death in 1702, as Michael Haken has observed, Collins was probably preaching to a congregation of roughly 700 people, which would have made his congregation one of the largest Calvinistic Baptist works in the city. I think that estimate's drawn from work that Michael Watts did in his work on the dissenters, where he talks about the sizes of the congregations in London during this period. Collins also exhorted his readers to persevere, for God has promised to reward the overcomers. He then draws on all the promises made by Christ in Revelation 2 and 3 to those who persevere through persecution. The overcomer shall eat of the tree in the midst of the paradise of God, not be hurt of the second death, have the hidden manna, have the white stone and a new name, have power over the nations and rule them with a rod of iron, and they shall be clothed in white raiment. Their name shall not be blotted out of the book of life, but made a pillar in the temple of God, and he shall go out no more. Finally, those who overcome shall sit with Christ on his throne, as he overcame, and sat down with the Father on his throne. These shall receive a crown not of gold but glory, not fading but eternal. Collins knew that his readers would be able to hold fast if they were fully satisfied with Christ. It's the Christ-finding soul which is the life-finding soul. Collins explained that what it said in Scripture, Christ is all and in all, that he is all because all good is comprehended in him. He is all in all in the fullness of all. For if we have all earthly enjoyments and have not him, we have nothing comparatively. However, to have Christ was to have all equivalently and comprehensively. Therefore, Collins warned that it was important to hold fast this Christ. The world, he declared, would try to sink you if you held it too closely to your heart. Cast away all, shake off all, rather than lose a Christ. True believers see God as the chief good and supreme happiness. Thus, will a believing soul suffer the loss of all so he may win Christ? None but Christ, saith an illuminated believer. Collins seemed to speak on behalf of the illuminated believer as he extolled how this view of the sufficiency of Christ enabled him personally to endure hardships in this life. There are many good objects in heaven and earth beside thee. There are angels in heaven and saints on earth. But what are these to thee? Heaven without thy presence would be no heaven to me. A palace with thee, a crown without thee, cannot satisfy me. But with thee I can be content, though in a poor cottage with thee I'm at liberty and bonds. Peace and trouble. If I have thy smiles, I can bear the world's frowns. If I have spiritual liberty in my soul, that I can ascend to thee by faith and have communion with thee, thou shalt choose my portion for me in this world. Some, however, were apparently being tempted to abandon the all-sufficient Christ for a respite from the persecution. Collins warned that without enduring to the end, all your profession, your many years' prayers, all your tears will be lost. Like the author of Hebrews, he's warning his believers in his congregation of believers in a period of persecution not to turn back. Those who turned aside mayst never more be called to be a witness for Christ, he said, and some have thought God hath not loved them because he hath not exercised them this way. In other words, there are some who have believed, if you're unfaithful at this opportunity, then you may not have another opportunity, is what he's saying. And that, for some, is a cause for God's people to think that God doesn't love them because he doesn't allow them to suffer for his sake and have opportunity to bear witness for him in the midst of persecution. Elsewhere in this prison epistle, Collins soberly charges those who had been enabled by God's grace to persevere not to boast in their state. To all such as have fallen in the storm, who have kept their garments from defiling, let God have the glory. Thou standest by faith, which God is author of. Be not high-minded, but fear. Glory not secretly. Rejoice not in thy brother's fall. For those who had fallen, Collins offered a word of hope. The Lord hath promised he will not let his anger fall upon you. Therefore, return, return, that we may look upon thee with joy and delight as the angels in heaven do rejoice at the returning of a soul to God. Collins further exhorts his wayward readers to return into the arms of a merciful God. Return to thy God from whom thou hast revolted, who stands with open arms to receive you. Return to the church again, whom thou hast made sad by thy departing from the truth, and humble thyself to God and them, and they will cheerfully receive thee into their fellowship. Saints would only be enabled to endure persecution, Collins said, who had first been putting to death the deeds of their flesh daily. Let not that man think to wear the cross of persecution that doth not first wear the cross of mortification. And I think this is especially helpful to us to think about if we think that we're going to endure persecution, we need to think about how we are daily putting to death the sins in our life. And that's what Collins is getting at here. Don't think that you're going to be able to endure persecution if you are not first wearing daily the cross of mortification, putting to death indwelling sin. He said we should inure ourselves to bear the public cross by wearing it first more privately in our houses, in our families, in our shops and trades. For let not that person think he will ever be able to part with his houses, lands, and liberties for the Lord Jesus Christ, that cannot first part with a secret lust. But if we have grace enough to wear daily the cross of mortification of the old man, you need not fear, but he that giveth grace to do the greater will give grace to do the lesser. For I look upon the subduing of corruption a greater thing than enduring persecution, though neither can be done as it ought without help from heaven. Those who by the grace of God were regularly putting to death their sins would experience an easier path in enduring physical persecution. Thus, Collins is encouraging personal holiness as the best means to prepare for persecution for the cause of Christ. Without this spiritual practice, professing believers would not be able to withstand the temptation to deny Christ in the face of persecution. Collins closes his sermon, A Voice from Prison, with a series of prayers to God. Collins prayed that God would purge the church of its impurities, which he saw as a cause for their persecution. God is contending with us, he said. Let us all banish and expel the Achan out of our hearts, out of our churches, and show ourselves zealous against sin. Second, Collins prayed that Christ's kingdom would come. We should be willing to be footstools so Christ thereby might get upon his throne. Third, Collins prayed for a universal spreading of the gospel in order that a greater degree of knowledge and holiness will be in the world than ever. Finally, Collins prayed for deliverance. We have no might, but our eyes are upon thee. Appear in thy strength that the kingdoms of the world may know that thou art God and that there is none besides thee. In the meantime, Collins concluded, let our faith and patience be lengthened out to the coming of the Lord, till time swallowed up in eternity, finite and infinite, hope in vision, and faith in fruition. When God shall be the matter of our happiness, when fullness shall be the measure of our happiness, and eternity the duration. These prison writings of Collins provide a window into better understanding both 17th century English Baptist spirituality and a Baptist theology of persecution. The furnace of affliction revealed a deep and vibrant spirituality which was like pure gold when tested. These golden writings are characterized by a confidence in the sovereign providence of God, a thankfulness for physical and spiritual blessings, reflection upon the sufficiency of Christ, and a certain expectation of a future deliverance and reward. It's hoped that a similar spirituality would become prominent among Baptists once again in order that we might be enabled to endure persecution that increasingly seems certain to come. Any questions? Yes, sir. Well, he doesn't write about this topic after toleration, so it's hard to say. But I think his theology is prepared for that in the fact that he's talking about, even in the midst of his suffering, that in God's providence, our suffering can end at any moment. In other words, not just through death and not just through future judgment, but also, if God wills, he can set us free right now. And so I think he would see that as this is God's sovereign plan. This is how he's chosen to work. So, thank you. Okay, any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
This is a really open-ended question, and you're free to tell me that it's too broad. But I'm just curious if you have any ideas, or if Dr. Aiken does, either one, about what lessons, if any, this period of persecution might have for us today in America, with on the issue of separation of church and state. And, you know, I listen to radio programs where people talk about this was a Christian nation and we need to turn it back to a Christian nation. Have you gleaned anything on that topic, or is that not of interest to you as you
It is of interest to me. I think Dr. Nettles is indicating he's going to address that in just a moment.
Absolutely. Anything you want to say, I'm just saying that I do have a few things to say, but there's a lot to get to say.
And then you can ask him the question.
Okay.
I think there's a vital link between those religious liberty and the separation of church and state. So when the state begins to make laws that affect religious liberty, in other words, in entering into a sphere where they should not be entering, then the result is inevitably going to be persecution of some form. And so there is a connection. And so you see it here in the 17th century, what it looked like. It's going to look very different in our context if that happens. And
see, I feel it happening on a cultural level, mm-hmm. not a statutory level, and in some cases statutorily.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if you have thoughts. But it's kind of an inflammatory question also, and I don't mean to blow things up.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
I'll let Dr. Nettles respond, and then we'll you can follow up with a question to him if you want to more specifics. Yes, Mr. Herod.
Yeah,
toward the end of A Voice from Prison, he has a page or two which are actual petitions of prayers. So he does pray specifically for some of these areas, including relief in terms of deliverance from prison. And so that's an excellent question and a great topic to pursue, the relationship between providence and prayer in Collins. I haven't pursued it specifically, but I think I have a sense that elsewhere, when he writes about divine sovereignty, he would have what, to use, you know, a term from today, a compatibilist view, anachronistic to use it that way, but he does have a sense of divine sovereignty and human responsibility, and that there is a relationship between the two that we don't fully understand. And I don't have those citations with me, but he does address that particular issue. And so I think that would also affect his view of prayer, where you see him talking very strongly about the providence of God. We're here by God's providence. God can end it sovereignly at any point. But he's also praying for these things, things that he says elsewhere are the results of God's sovereign activity. So it's not fatalistic in that sense. Okay, someone else?